From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In 2009, four men from Newburgh, New York, were arrested for plotting to bomb two Jewish centers in the Bronx and shoot Stinger missiles at parked military cargo jets. The arrests were intense and dramatic. More than 100 law enforcement officers with assault rifles. There were helicopters, armored vehicles, a bomb squad. The filmmakers of a documentary about this case say those arrests were mostly theater, that the men were hapless street thugs from an impoverished neighborhood who had been lured into this scheme by a sketchy FBI informer. The film says the case against the men wasn't counterterrorism, in fact, but entrapment. We're screening the film tomorrow. We're talking about it today. It's called The Newburgh Sting, after the news.
Hi, this is Benjamin Bombard, one of the producers of Radio West. Our online audio and podcasts are made possible by KUER and its listeners. If you like Radio West, help us make it happen. You can donate $10 right now by texting KUER to 85944. That's KUER to 85944. And thanks.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. In 2009, four men were arrested for conceiving a terrorist plot, for planning to bomb two Jewish centers in the Bronx and to shoot Stinger missiles at military cargo jets. In David Heilbronner's documentary film, you see this contrast between the way the story was portrayed in the media and told by the FBI and how it actually played out on the streets of Newburgh, New York, where the men are from. News reports and press conferences said that these were Muslim men who had been radicalized in prison and had hatched their plot at a local mosque. Officials say it was a textbook case of how a counterterrorism investigation should be run. But on the street, these four men were known as hapless but harmless thugs with no real religion or ideology. These were men who had been lured into a scheme by an FBI informant with a sketchy past to promised them a lot of money, life-changing money, as one former FBI agent explains it in the film. Today on the program, we are continuing our series on documentaries, and we're talking about this film. It's called The Newburgh Sting. We're going to be screening it tomorrow in Salt Lake City. We'll give you the details about that as we go along, but we're talking about it today with David Heilbronner, and you can join us. 801-585-WEST is the number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. I'd also like to hear from those of you on Facebook and on Twitter. David Heilbronner co-created this film, The Newburgh Sting, alongside his frequent collaborator, Kate Davis. They've also created the films Jockey and Stonewall Uprising. And he's joining us today from the studios of member station WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. And David Heilbronner, welcome to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I guess we should start by asking, when is it that you first encountered this story? Even before you thought about it as a film, when did you first hear about this?
Well, you know, I'm a lifelong New Yorker, and so the first time I heard about it was this first time the general public heard about it. You know, it was on the front page of every newspaper in the city. Four Muslim extremists have been caught by the FBI trying to bomb a synagogue. And, you know, like everybody, I went, great, you know, good job, FBI. Catch a crime before it happens. You know, you saved everybody. And I believed it for a long time. I mean, what happened afterwards is, you mentioned the film Stonewall Uprising. I was showing that film at my old law school. I was a prosecutor about 25 years ago. Huh. So I go back and show my films at law schools a lot of the time.
Right.
And one of my professors said, you got to take a look at the FBI and the American Muslim community. There's really a lot of bad blood. It's a lot of misconduct on the FBI's part. And I spent about a year looking for what might be sort of the perfect case to illustrate what's going on and what's wrong. And the Newburgh Sting case, the Newburgh Four, as it was known at the time, was the obvious choice because, unlike so many other FBI cases, these guys decided to take it to trial. And as a result, the film is made up of all the FBI's own undercover videotapes. So you can really – this is not an example of people accusing the FBI and you have to accept their word over the word of the FBI. You can just see for yourself what actually happened. And we had a trove of, you know, more than 100 hours of material. And the film really just tells the story through these tapes.
Yeah. I was a little surprised by the fact that you had so much of that surveillance footage. I guess it's public record, so they couldn't really say, no, you can't have that, and, no, you can't use it.
Well, it's public record, but like so many public records, if you go through the proper channels, it takes forever. Things can be redacted.
Yeah.
This was given to me unedited by sources I can't name. I don't know what would have happened had we filed a Freedom of Information request. We certainly would have gotten a lot. What we got was everything, which was, you know, it was really unsettling because I kept looking for the other side of the story, that there had to be, the FBI really had to be onto something legitimate here. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the harder we looked, the scarier it got, because there was no crime. The FBI really made this up out of nothing.
You know, I wonder if you think about when you were originally started thinking about this, did you see it as one element of a larger pattern, or did you think, no, this is a particular isolated incident? I mean, how are you thinking about that in the sense that this is one pretty dreadful, frightening story from your perspective, or that this is the result of a reflection of something larger?
Yeah, you know, that was really a concern of ours, because it was such an egregious case. This is not a close call. You know, you go to an impoverished community and find four people who don't even know each other and offer them $250,000, tell them where to go, literally provide the fake weapons for them, and then tell the public you've infiltrated a ring that existed for a year and wanted to buy the weapons. Yeah, it's fraud, really, is what it is. The FBI is creating a PR film to enhance their own sense of efficacy and relevance. And unfortunately, this seems to be happening all around the country, that this is the FBI's new modus operandi of what they would call getting out left of boom. You know, boom is the terrorist attack, right of boom is after it happens. Mm-hmm. And the FBI is great at that. They figure out who did the attack, you know, what the weapons were made of, where the material came from. Left of boom is this new mentality that's come into the FBI after 9/11. They want to get ahead of people who even they may not know they're going to be sucked into a terrorist plot.
Right.
And so they're going around trying to lure people who don't have a plan in mind into doing something. And that's where you get into really, really dangerous territory. And so it's a national issue, still going on. The FBI stands by this procedure. And we're trying to use the film as a way to change that.
Yeah. I want to sort of lay out the story as we go along, but since you mentioned the role of the FBI and how things had changed after 9/11, let's talk about Mike German. He is an important character in the film. He's this undercover FBI agent. You have these images, these pictures of him undercover, and he looks like a kind of hippie guy. It's interesting to see that contrast with the man who you actually interview, who looks like a Mormon.
Yeah.
You know, like
no Mike.
Super
He's
clean
a Boy Scout.
Cut. Yeah, a Boy Scout. Absolutely. I mean, it's really, really amazing. But he is clearly outraged by some of the stuff that's going on after 9/11. And I wanted to play a clip from the film, because he talks about, he spent a lot of time working undercover, this man, Mike German.
He says 12 years.
12 years in undercover for terrorism stuff, and he says it was everything that he wanted it to be. But then he talks about in this clip how the rules changed after 9/11. You're also going to hear from Thomas Fuentes, by the way, who's the former FBI assistant director, talking about the rules and how things changed after 9/11. Here's a clip from the Newberg sting.
The mood within the FBI after 9/11 was that the rules don't apply anymore.
The FBI was being threatened with being carved up. We're going to create MI5 out of part of the FBI. But the one message that was clear, and for me and the other FBI executives at the time, it was there will be no tolerance for another terrorist attack in this country under any circumstances.
Immediately after 9/11, I mean, there were actually FBI agents going through the hallway saying, the rules are off now, the rules are off. And I remember saying to one, what rules are you talking about? You know, are you talking about the Constitution? Do you think the Constitution is off? So, unfortunately, part of what the FBI did was treat the entire Muslim community as suspect.
How important was Mike German, and Thomas Fuentes for that matter, to getting some perspective in the film.
Yeah, you know, they were really pivotal in giving the film, I think, the credibility that it needs. I'm a former prosecutor. I have a great deal of respect for the FBI and for your rank and file prosecutor and police officer, because it's dangerous work, and they really do care about what they care about. You know, the honor and integrity for most people out there. That's really very meaningful. And so when you make a film like this, you got to be really sure that you're getting it right and that you understand it from the perspective of people who are out in the field. So, you know, Mike German had spent 12 years working undercover, literally doing just what the FBI is now doing, but under a whole different mentality, a different set of rules. And he left the FBI because he saw them veering off into what he considered to be illegal territory.
Yeah.
Tom Fuentes was also important because he was an executive at the time. And I found him because the FBI refused to go on camera and talk about their policies or what happened in this case.
Right.
They literally froze us out. I appealed to people very high in the bureau, and the answer was always no. We simply won't go on camera in your movie. So I said, well, I've got to get somebody to stand up for this and show the other side. And I found Tom Fuentes, and I asked him, can you give the FBI side of the story? And he said, sure, I love the Bureau. I'm a lifer. I left at 11:59 p.m. my last day. You know, I would have stayed forever. He aged out. Yeah. And when I interviewed him, you know, it was astonishing because his attitude was that he was really disapproving of what's going on in the Bureau now, even though I'd asked him to stand up for it. And he essentially, you know, later in the film says, we can't go to Congress and say we're doing great on the war against terror. They'll cut our budget in half. He said, our motto is to keep fear alive. And so they actually give, I think, some credibility to the notion that the accusation that the film levels at the Bureau isn't some half-baked conspiracy theory. That is just it's an accurate factual accounting of what is going on right now with our law enforcement, our federal law enforcement.
One of the characters in the film, at least the way I saw it, is Newburgh, New York. This community, it's about 60 miles north of New York City. The community itself, the neighborhood, that place, is that accurate? It's a character?
Oh, Newburgh is undoubtedly a character. And it's a character that plays a central role in the film.
Yeah.
Because it's one of the most demoralized and depressed cities that you're likely to see in the United States. Has probably a 30% unemployment rate. You know, 5 out of 6 buildings are boarded up and uninhabitable, probably condemned. And you walk around the streets, and you know, I've been to bad neighborhoods. I've been to Camden and parts of Baltimore that everybody knows are dangerous and scary. And this is right up there with the worst places in the country. And why that's important is because the FBI chooses this incredibly apolitical place. Mm-hmm. Most of people they're just trying to get by day to day, and they send an undercover informant into the one nice building in town, which is the mosque, and looking for people who will eventually do stuff for money. And when you dangle money, really large amounts of money, in front of desperate people, you're always going to get someone who will go along with the game. And so it's terribly cynical of them. They've taken this desperate town, and instead of, you know, setting up a jobs program or mentor program, they send in an undercover agent and dangling money, and then suck 4 hapless guys into this fake plot. If I were a Newburgh citizen and I've shown the film in Newburgh and talked to members of the community, it darkens your view of the government further still. It's not only is it a character, it's a tragic character.
Well, I also liked, though, the use of Bryant Baker, for example, who's a really great killer bee is sort of his nickname. And there are a number of guys who are just sort of guys in the neighborhood that you talk to that are important elements in the story, you know, the way they talk about not just their relationship with the men involved, but the relationship to that place. Like, place is an important part of the story.
It is, and yeah, it's a sad postscript to the film. Both Bryant and this other guy, T is all he wanted to be known as, the letter T. His real name is Terry. are back in prison. When we showed the film, because I wanted to bring the film back to the community and just let them know that, you know, we really didn't just want to come in and use their story and go make a film and win some awards and never see them again.
Yeah.
So I've been going back to Newburgh and working with the families a lot. And Bryant and Terry, who were both so proud of having climbed out of poverty. Bryant owned a bar. And you know, as a young, what is the word? A young capitalist, if you will,
right?
Young entrepreneur, better yeah. word, yeah. entrepreneur. And Terry was working at a barbershop, you know, and had a young daughter, and was really proud of having found honest work and made something good out of his life. And you know, they're both back in prison. Bryant got into a street fight and broke somebody's jaw. It was really, really dumb. You should definitely get into trouble, but. The pressures of life in Newburgh, even when you're trying to climb out, are tough. So it's a sad story, but they give a very accurate picture of street level view from Newburgh.
Well, what's great about that to me, in terms of just as a piece of art, the film is not just a bunch of talking heads that are talking about, you know, a pattern of whatever it might be. That it's also a reflection of these men's lives and that place. And I think that's. I have to say, kind of refreshing for a film like that, like this.
Well, which, you know, we wanted the film to have to work as a movie, you know, not just as my partner Kate and I call an "Eat Your Broccoli" documentary,
right.
Where you learn all these useful facts, but it isn't fun going down. You know, the film is part thriller, really.
Yeah.
You know, you follow these aerial surveillance things and watch people make bombs, and they're actually explosions. How many documentaries have real explosions in them?
Right.
And on the other hand, it's also sort of. Personal drama. You know, it's not just a thriller with guns and missiles, which there are, but it's the story of people who are being cynically manipulated by the government, people whose lives are often in tragedy. One of the three Newburgh Four defendants, you know, is a schizophrenic man living in a halfway house. He was penniless.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a guy who is now serving 25 years for terrorism. He had learning disabilities. He was hearing voices since he was a child. His pants fell down during the arraignment at court. And to take someone like that and just use them as a pawn in a political chess game is, I think, you know, really shameful.
Let's explain how we get to Newburgh, because you mentioned in the spring of 2008, the FBI sends another crucial character in this story, an undercover informant to Newburgh on this mission, as you put it in the film, to find terrorists. Now, let's talk about this man. He's Shahad Hussein.
Shahad Hussein.
Shahad Hussein.
Yeah.
A man who has this kind of carefully crafted persona. He's a little mysterious. Comes across or wants to come across as wealthy, saying he drives expensive cars and he tries to spread money around. But he seems really sketchy.
Sketchy
is the word I keep coming back to.
Shahad Hussein is an incredibly sketchy guy. And part of that comes with the territory. You know, if you want to have an undercover – it takes a thief to catch a thief,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
And so if you want to have an undercover informant – you know, you don't want an upright citizen because they don't mingle with terrorists. You want someone who might actually mingle with terrorists. And so the FBI found this guy, Shahad Hussein, who was Pakistani, had very weird connections with politics, had bank accounts with strange amounts of money going through them. Nobody to this day has figured out quite what really went on there.
Right.
But the way the FBI found him was he was up in upstate New York, working at a DMV, taking driver's tests for other Pakistanis and lying about it and cheating on their applications. And so he was arrested for fraud. And, you know, the FBI took one look at the guy and went, you know, have I got a job for you?
Wow.
And basically the job is we'd like you to go around to mosques, hang out at mosques, talk about jihad, talk about radical politics, and find somebody who you think might commit a terrorist act. And every time you find a case that we think we can prosecute, we'll give you about $65,000. And if we get a conviction, you get an undisclosed bonus. And so, and this is how the FBI works. It's not just this one case. This is exactly how informants are paid in every case around the country. The amounts of money change, but the basic idea is if you don't find bad guys, you don't get paid. So there's a huge amount of incentive for Hussein to dig somebody up. And if you when you watch the film, you'll see when he finally finds one guy, it all starts with him finding a man named James Cromedy, who was a pot dealer, worked a night shift at Walmart, and, you know, sort of an aimless local blowhard, who was a racist, you know, guy with nasty views about things, but would never have done anything. And he finds Cromedy, and he just latches onto him and pursues him. And Cromedy eventually disappears for months, and Hussein is calling, you know, where are you, where are you? And if this was a terrorist in the making, you wouldn't have to pursue him.
Right.
He would be pursuing Hussein.
Well, I want to come back to James Cromedy, but I want to play another clip from the film. This is Hamin Rashada, who's the assistant imam at this mosque in Newburgh, because he talks about seeing Shahed Hussein there in the mosque. And everyone's sort of looking askance at this guy. Like, he's not one of us. He's not a member, but he's hanging around, throwing money around, driving nice cars. And talking about something that the people in this mosque in Newburgh have no interest in, which is this idea of jihad. Here's another clip. It's from the Newburgh sting.
I first met him. It was on a Friday. I'd done the Juma here, the Friday prayer service here. And I met him out here in this very parking lot. I said, can I help you? He said, yeah. I'm sure you can tell me, you know, about jihad. That of all the things for him to be concerned about, he would ask about jihad. He would ask about a holy war.
And we asked Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to protect his people from any more harm.
I did tell different individuals, I said, stay the hell away from him. Some ain't right about it.
Now, this is another character in the film, I have to say, the Newburgh, the mosque there, because it does raise larger questions about Muslim Americans, and we're going to get to that a little bit more. But this, but say something about that part of the film, if you will, because this is another part of the story.
Well, sure. You know, I think one of the things that we felt was important in our film was to bring to life the true American Muslim experience, which, you know, it's there's a tremendous amount of Islamophobia at large in our society, even now, even 10 years plus after 9/11. And you go to this mosque, which is actually an immaculately clean, beautiful building in a dreadful community. And the imam and the assistant imam, Hamin Rashada, are these gracious, lovely people who welcome you in and don't have a radical bone in their body. And you realize that they're just deeply religious men who want to worship in peace and build a community. So as the film, which will take you inside the mosque and you'll see sort of the services and you'll meet some of the people, you begin to see how nasty it is that the FBI sends in someone like Shahed Hussein to foment political violence. And so, Hamin Rashada was by the end of the film, you'll see he cries over this because he's so upset at seeing his holy place defiled.
David Heilbronner is with us together with Kate Davis. He created the documentary film, The Newburgh Sting. You can see it tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Downtown Library in Salt Lake City. It's part of our Through the Lens documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We'll have details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. You can join us if you like. 801-585-WEST is the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're profiling another film in our documentary series. It's an expose, a shocking expose, really, about the role of the FBI in the years after 9/11. And what the filmmakers say has been a pattern in some ways of the agency to target Muslim communities in poor neighborhoods. And in some cases, at least in this particular case of the Newburgh Four, to actually lure them into considering acts of terrorism. The film is called The Newburgh Sting. David Heilbronner co-created it along with Kate Davis, and we're screening it tomorrow. And we should mention there's going to be a Q&A after the film. David will be joining us there at the screening. His wife, Kate, will be with us via Skype for a conversation after that. We'll give you the details about that a little bit later. David Heilbronner is joining us today from the studios of member station WCAI in Woods Hole, Massachusetts. Well, let's talk more about James Cromedy. I want to play another clip from the film here because I wish I had pulled more clips from the surveillance tape because some of it's so absurd and so remarkable. But there's this moment we're going to hear Mark, is it Gobiner?
Gombiner.
Gombiner, forgive me. He's one of the defense attorneys. They're great characters, too. We should probably talk about them as we go along. But he's talking about James Cromedy and who he is. And maybe you should tell the story of because it's you tell in the story how Hussein and Cromedy actually meet. Cromedy likes Hussein's shoes.
Yeah, Cromedy, Hussein's hanging out in the parking lot because basically no one in the mosque really wants much to do with Hussein. They won't talk to him. They realize there's something really shady about him. And James Cromedy, you have to set the scene a little bit. James Cromedy is a 55-year-old blowhard. Yeah. He is sort of like Homer Simpson on steroids with a slight criminal whiff as well. Yeah. He's a scam artist, basically. And he meets probably the first well-to-do man he's met in ages. Hussein is driving a couple of BMWs. He comes up with a Mercedes and a Hummer. And he befriends Cromedy, who talks up his own, terrorist bona fides. And he tells Hussein, I committed this murder. I shot a 12-year-old. I've bombed police stations. None of which was true. Had the FBI bothered to check? I mean, Hussein thought, wow, I've really found a terrorist. This guy's bombed police stations. He's killed people. He's proud of it. And, if they had actually looked it up, they would have found that all James Cromedy has ever been arrested for has been selling marijuana. And so they meet in the parking lot, and Hussein is wearing these Pakistani shoes. Cromedy says, those look like Pakistani shoes. And Cromedy says, I've been to Pakistan, which he hadn't been to.
Right.
And they struck up this friendship that went on for months. And that's how the two, that's where the story really begins.
Here's a clip from the Neubergstein.
To someone like Mr. Cromedy, who had spent his entire life in poverty, trying to support himself as a very low-level marijuana dealer, also working the night shift at Walmart, making about $14,000 a year, I mean, that was a very big thing to him, Mr. Shahid Hussein's wealth. And Hussein played on that tremendously.
What is your understanding that you make a lot of money and still be on the side of Allah?
That'll be good, but I have to know what I'm going to do to make the money.
I have a lot of ideas, for you,
I have a lot of ideas for you. Cromedy figures he's hit the jackpot, of course, here. Doesn't seem, of course, all that interested in the plot itself, but when you start talking about money, that becomes an interesting issue. And there's this moment that happens in the film, which is really interesting. You mentioned that in 2009, he kind of disappears, James Cromedy. He loses contact with Hussein. Nothing seems to be happening. And Hussein is looking around for him like, this is my only lead here. He goes to the mosque, asks people, where's James? What's going on? And finally, he's able to reconnect with him. And this is another moment from the film that I wanted to play. Because you hear this conversation, which really gets to the question of money, because we're talking about a lot of money here. This is James Cromedy and Sahed Hussein, again from the film The Neubergstein.
Hello. You remember me now? Talk to me.
No, brother.
You could talk to me.
Listen to me. Listen to me. I don't left the place and everything. I just left.
I can make you $250,000, but you don't want it. What can I tell you?
We can laugh. Okay, come see me, brother.
$250,000, David Heilbronner. Talk about, because that's life-changing money, as is mentioned in the film.
Well, it's life-changing money to most everybody, but in Newburgh, New York, it's exponentially more.
Yeah.
This is the amount of money that simply nobody on the streets dreams of having ever. So Hussein is offering him what might as well be $250 million. So it's astonishing. Cromedy is just blown away by it and sucked into it and mesmerized by this offer. And that's the pivotal moment in the quote-unquote plot, because how this FBI had to have this crime unfold is that they had to have not just one person who would agree to commit the crime, because there's no conspiracy, and that's the only way that you can prosecute these cases. They had to get more people. So Cromedy first had to get on the hook, and then he had to take that money and go out on the streets and spread the word that there's all this money available. And so Shortly after that, Cromedy hits the streets and finds three accomplices. And that's, you know, that's where you watch this terribly, terrible cynicism of the FBI, which sold this case to the public as we spent a year surveilling a terrorist ring. And what you see in the film, and it's just there is no counterargument, is that these are four guys who never met. And you watch them, they don't know each other, and you watch them one by one come into the plot.
The characters I want to talk a little bit about, but there's this moment where Hussein drives them now. He has his conspirators together. Hussein drives them to the airport at Stewart Air Force Base, which is important because this idea of blowing up planes now, which Hussein has in mind. Again, this is important, I guess we should say, David Hallbronner, because this is not their idea. This is
correct.
Hussein's idea.
Yeah, the film shows that when actually Hussein asks Cromedy, you know, give me your ideas for a plot. What do you want to do? What do you want to do? And Cromedy says, well, I'd like to blow up a bridge. And Hussein says, no, you can't blow up a bridge. It's too hard. So then he says, what else? And you can't list everything in the movie, but what happens in the tapes is Cromedy came up with lots of ideas.
Yeah.
And Hussein kept saying no. So Hussein kept steering him to what he wanted. And so, you know, that's when Hussein drops his hint about the Air Force Base. And then Cromedy says, okay.
The idea is that sort of the clincher point, he says, I can get you, Hussein says, I can get you a missile. And that's right. another step forward. Talk a little bit about that because, and I also want you to mention, there's this absolutely absurd scene where they're in the car and they're talking about this idea of shooting a missile at these planes. David Williams, another one of them, and James Cromedy himself, they're worried about the potential of that somebody could actually get hurt. And as David Williams says, what if someone's in the plane cleaning it? Which goes to this idea that, as he says in the clip, look, we're interested in destroying property, but we don't want to take no lives, as he says.
Word for word. Yeah. And you see him, you know, it's a, what you say in film, it's a sync shot. You see him, you know, you see his face talking and hear the words at the same time. So there's no way, if you have many members of the audience who might go, this is just too far-fetched. How could the FBI really be doing this? No, you will see him say, we're not interested in taking any lives. And Cromedy says, that's right. We're not in it for just taking lives. We're in it for destroying property. And this is, you know, and you watch what complete buffoons these two guys are. They have no idea how to use a Stinger missile. They've talked about how they've seen them on TV, kinda. And it's funny from a sort of Quentin Tarantino point of view of a bunch of, you know, clowns trying to commit these crimes that just really, truly don't know anything about bombs or weapons of mass destruction of any kind whatsoever, sort of going along and playing along with Hussein. The only problem is they end up serving 25 years hard time because they were this farce that they're playing out is used by the FBI and sold to the public as real.
Yeah. I want to talk about the day of the arrest of the crime itself, May 20th. This is 2009, of course. Now, they drive up to Connecticut. Now, that's crucial. Mm-hmm. Why, David Hallbronner?
Well, this investigation took place in Newburgh, New York. And these guys, none of them have a driver's license. They don't have a bicycle. So they never leave Newburgh on their own. They can't. They don't have any money for a bus ticket even. So Hussein has to have them cross state lines in order to create a federal crime. Otherwise, it's a state crime and the FBI has no business prosecuting it. So he drives them in his car out to Connecticut to, quote, you know, pick up these missiles, which the FBI obviously provided and could have dropped off in New York. So he creates, you know, federal jurisdiction, if you will. He creates a conspiracy, which didn't happen. And he, by the way, providing the Stinger missile, which these guys didn't ask for, you can see Hussein suggesting it, also created something really nasty, which is there's a minimum sentence. If these guys are convicted of conspiracy to fire a Stinger missile, the lowest sentence you can get for that is 25 years. So it's you watch the FBI meticulously. They're very good at it, creating this trap for these four guys. And you watch the trap snap shut, you know, at one point.
Let me play a clip from – because you hear the media coverage that you yourself, David Hallbronner, talked about. You heard this story, the way it played out, the way it was conveyed by the media, and also the way it was really talked about by the FBI. You're going to hear various news anchors here, some you may recognize. You'll also hear the voice of Joseph Demarest. Is he former assistant director of the FBI?
No, David? I think he's still with the Bureau.
Still with the Bureau.
I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
Again, another clip from the Newberg sting.
The FBI says it has thwarted a terror plot.
Federal agents moved in tonight and say their suspects are homegrown would-be terrorists.
The men put what they believe to be bags of plastic explosives, C4, a total of 30 pounds, into the cars. But when they returned to their SUV, officers rushed the vehicle, smashed the windows, and made the arrests.
What have you learned?
There were four people involved, all Muslims. And my understanding is originally this emanated from the mosque in Newburgh, New York.
This is a group that we knew about. This is a group that, you know, through tripwires that we have set up, through, you know, various communities, sources, and the like, networks that we have set up, we're able to determine that, you know, there was a distinct interest by this group to conduct an attack.
A group we knew about, a network, that they were interested in something like that. I mean, when you know the backstory, you get a sense of how absurd that is.
Oh, it's awful. You know, later in the film, you see the director of the FBI, Robert Mueller, parroting the same language and telling Congress that we've disrupted these plots. No, they haven't disrupted anything, and there was no network. They created a crime, and they created a work of theater that was. And hearing that, there's a really telling moment here, because when you hear all those sirens and when you see the film, you'll see the enormous amount of manpower brought to bear. You have to understand, these are four hapless guys, unarmed, coming in from Newburgh in a car driven by the FBI's own informant. The weapons that they, the quote-unquote bombs that they were going to explode, were provided by the FBI. They were completely inert. So you have to ask yourself, what does it take to arrest four guys who are unarmed and don't have weapons? And the answer is it does not take helicopters and bomb squads and 100 cops. They had the Joint Terrorism Task Force, the New York Sheriff's Office, the NYPD, the FBI. You get the idea. It was completely theatrical. And one of the things that we hope to do with this film in order to bring the FBI, you know, to held to account for this is to, well, I'm trying to get Congress to follow the money trail. You know, who approved these expenses? This is expensive stuff. And just, it's absolutely unnecessary. The only reason you would do it is for, you know, television time.
Yeah. I want to ask you about, there's a terrific character in the film, Elisa McWilliams, who is David Williams, who's one of the Newburgh Four. It's her aunt, his aunt. And, she's just really candid. She's really raw. And she seems such an important teller of this story. And I wanted to play this. We've cleaned it up a little bit for obvious reasons. she uses some intense language here. But she's talking about – I wanted people to get a sense of her, because then I wanted you to talk about her as a character in this story. But she's talking about that day when David – is and the rest of them are arrested, because as you mentioned, this was quite a production. Bulletproof vests and helicopter assault and assault rifles and armored vehicles and a tractor trailer was involved in all of these bomb squads. And Elisa sees this, McWilliams, David Williams' aunt, sees this on the television screen, and this is her reaction from the film, The Newburgh Sting.
A call woke me up 3 o'clock in the morning, saying that they kicked in Lissy's house. And on the TV, all you see was David. You see Homeland Security, FBI, NYPD. I said, what the f*** did you do? I'm cussing the TV out. I'm like, what the f*** did you do? I had to sit there and cry. This is some heavy s*** you pulled us into. This is political, like a mother. This is terrorism.
Say something about Elisa McWilliams. There's a kind of street wisdom here that she tells the story in a sort of a candid, authentic way that I think seems really important to the story.
You know, I have to say, every time we show the film, I think Elisa's the character people remember best.
Yeah.
She's so smart. She really gets it. She gets the politics. You see, I mean, this is full of like some pretty funny lines in a way, because her language is just so outrageous.
Right.
But she really gets the politics in a deep way, as you'll find out later when if you see the film. She understands far more than you'd imagine, because she's an impoverished black woman who you're sitting here with cigarette smoke going up in the back of the frame, and you sort of don't expect this kind of passion and analysis and insight. We had a nice review in the New York Times recently, and they called her magnificent in her dark humor.
Right.
And I have to say, I'm proud to call Alicia a friend. She blew away all of my preconceptions about what kind of insight and political awareness you can expect from I hate to admit that I have those preconceptions, but she blew me away. And and she's funny.
Yeah.
And the film, as political as it is, the whole film is funny. That's you laugh until the end when you're mad as when you're so mad you want to throw tomatoes. And Alicia is part of that, because she later says, you know, how could you come into our community and prey on these damn fools? David, my nephew, should only have gotten 5 years for not having common sense.
Right.
You know, and because she's right. These guys should not have played along with this. It's not that they're innocent.
Right.
And it's very important for people to understand that they did go along with this. And anybody in their right mind should have met Shahed Hussein and done what everybody else in the mosque did, which is just keep their distance. This is a weirdo. So they went along, and they are not perfect, but they're not terrorists. And that's what the film is really about, is that the FBI is taking fall guys and using them to create a theatrical production that makes the public believe two nasty things. One is that Muslims are more likely to commit terrorist acts than non-Muslims, which is just factually inaccurate. And the other is that there is a menace that requires the FBI to have a bigger and bigger budget. And the way you create that menace is by staging theatrical events that generate headlines. And Alicia really got that. And she's been fighting this passionately ever since the arrest.
David Heilbronner is with us, along with Kate Davis. He co-created the documentary film The Newburgh Sting. You can see it tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. It's at the Downtown Library in Salt Lake City. It's part of our Through the Lens series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. David, you're going to be here. I didn't mention
yes.
that last time. Yes.
Yeah, so I will be there. My wife and partner, Kate, with whom I've made many films, not just the two you mentioned, Jockey but whatever. We've made a bunch of films. She can't be here. She'll be there via Skype. But yeah, I'll be there, and I am told we may get some local FBI to attend as well, because I would love. I am really wanting to have an open public discussion about this, because when I show this film to former FBI agents, and I have done so, I even showed it to Deputy Commissioner of the Los Angeles Police Department, who's the head of the Anti-Terrorism Task Force. I thought he'd hate the film, and I thought he'd be mad at me. And he pulled me aside and he says, "What can I do to help you?" He says, "You're right. This is really a problem." We're gaining some traction. And the more people in law enforcement who see this film, I think we'll understand something needs to change.
You can get the details about that on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. Again, tomorrow night at 7. We'll take another break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with filmmaker David Heilbronner. We're talking about his film, The Newburgh Sting, which we are screening tomorrow night in downtown Salt Lake City. We'll give you the details about that a little bit later in the program. He created the film with his partner, wife, Kate Davis. And I wanted to ask you, one of the things you've talked about, the question, of course, whether or not this is entrapment comes up. But what's interesting is you've said, David Heilbronner, that this really didn't come down to a question of legalities as much as it did the nature of the way the story plays out in a courtroom, like the optics of the story, like the imagery, I guess.
Well, you know, when this case went to trial, you know, it's only 9 years after the 9/11 attacks. The courtroom itself was, you could, if you were a juror, you walk out within 1 minute of leaving the courtroom, you could be at ground zero. Mm-hmm. And into this courtroom, the FBI hauls, you know, these four sort of, you know, beat up looking guys and a Stinger missile. And they show pictures of this synagogue that they attempted to bomb. Speaking of theatrics, I mean, the FBI provided C4 explosive fake C4 explosive for these guys to plant in this car outside this synagogue, which they did plant. They did it at night so no one would be hurt, no one would be around. Obviously, they shouldn't have done it. But the prosecutors then had the FBI go down to Quantico and take real C4 explosive and create a real bomb and blow it up. And they took a video of it and showed it to the jury, which is, again, one more example of the theatrical nature of this. These guys didn't order the bomb. They didn't create the bomb. They don't know anything about bombs. So the FBI made the bomb the size they wanted, the material they wanted. These guys just went along with it. So then to blow it up and show the jury how powerful it is just ludicrous. But
well, not only that, James Cromedy doesn't even know how to wire the bomb, and he doesn't even actually set the bomb off. That's not going to go off anyway. But it's crazy.
Yeah, he doesn't even turn it on. There's an on-off switch. It says on-off. And when they got it, it was in the off position. There's a good argument to be made that Cromedy was actually trying to scam Shahed Hussein. And you went along with it up to the point of actually doing something violent. The jury didn't buy it. They might have bought it. But 2020 hindsight, the lawyers were actually very good in this case, although they're all publicly appointed. And they're in the film. Sam Braverman is a wonderful raconteur. With the whole film, we've got very, very fortunate to find such great storytellers. Of all the documentaries we've made, I think this has the best storytellers. So we were, which was good. And you need to be a good storyteller as a lawyer. But the jury ultimately, I think has this fear factor of, if someone once said, synagogue plus bomb equals conviction. And they didn't want to let these guys go. They didn't want to run the risk of, gee, what if the FBI is right? What if these guys would have signed on to Al-Qaeda and blown up something else for real? That's, I think, what happened in the courtroom. And it's truly, the problem is so multifaceted. It shouldn't have ever gotten to the courtroom in the first place. There should never have been this sting. The prosecutor's office never should have taken the case. But there is a mentality in our government that if we can create this illusion of fear, it justifies all kinds of power for law enforcement and lots of money. And, it's sort of the fulfillment of the Eisenhower military-industrial complex warning.
Let's take a quick call. Drew is with us in Salt Lake City. Drew, welcome.
Yeah, I just had a question. I was wondering if you considered that perhaps this FBI stuff is more of a strategy, and that this is a strategy where they're weighing the lesser of two evils, which would be, put the screws to some people to create some intimidation and control, as opposed to the potential of a secular war right here in America, considering everybody's got guns in America.
Great question.
Answer off the air.
Yeah. Go ahead.
No, man, that's true. That's a really smart question, and it is indeed part of a strategy. The FBI is not completely cynical, and the film doesn't portray them as such. I think the road to hell is paved with good intentions. The strategy here that they're trying to do is to find anyone who might go along with it with a terrorist recruiter and get them off the streets. The problem is, let's say you find someone like James Cromedy. You don't want to create the illusion that he's really a terrorist, and you don't want to create the illusion in the public's eye that that there really is a Muslim ring in Newburgh. You should get James Cromedy on a gun charge. It would take about a week. It would cost virtually nothing. He would go to jail for a very long time, and you would effectively get rid of the people you're trying to eliminate from the pool of recruitees that Al-Qaeda would prey upon. Instead, they've gone too far. They've taken this strategy and it's gotten way out of control. You don't need to do this. You could have the same result: spend less money, not spread Islamophobia, not create the illusion of terrorist rings blooming all over the place in America, and be just as effective. And that's why I want to bring the FBI to the table. I think people need to answer those questions: why that isn't a better way to go.
Let me ask you this. Finally, this question comes up. At least to me, it did anyway. This idea of whether or not we're safer, and Mike German, really the former FBI and undercover agent, mentions this kind of irony that while they were spending all of these resources on this particular investigation, there were real terrorists out there. Say something about that, if you would.
Well, sure. This is the reality is that we're actually less safe because of this misuse of resources for two reasons. One, just what you were saying, which is it siphons off money and manpower from what I would call legitimate investigations, like the Tsarnaev brothers. You know, when Russia tells you, you should watch out for these guys. They're politically radical and they're coming back to your country. And, you know, the FBI devoted some manpower, but they completely misread the situation. It would be possible to imagine that had this is exactly at the time that the Nuremberg sting was happening. Had they taken those resources and that manpower and done twice as much work on Tsarnaev, who knows? Maybe we'd have prevented the Boston Marathon bombing, which would have been a tremendous, tremendously fantastic achievement. The other downside of pursuing this strategy is that Al-Qaeda really does exist and does want to do harm to America, and they're not dumb. They follow the U.S. news, and they are going to take cases, cynical manipulation of the American public and besmirching of the name of legitimate Muslims, nonviolent, non-radical Muslims, and they're going to use cases like this to say, look what kind of country America is. Look how they're cynically using Islam. You know, this is a country worth hating. And so on two fronts, it backfires and makes us less safe.
About a minute left. Explain where the Nuremberg Four are now. They're in a supermax prison, just short, you point out in the film, of sensory deprivation for 25 years.
Well, yeah, these guys are labeled as terrorists, and terrorists are, you know, down at the lowest end of the totem pole in prison conditions. Sadly, one of them, Laguerre Payen, who was schizophrenic and had learning disabilities, and has been in 4-point restraint now for close to a year. He's totally lost it. According to his lawyer, he's virtually incoherent. He'll die in prison. He'll go insane, completely insane, and then he'll die in prison, which is just so tragic. And the other three, you know, life in these maxi facilities will drive you crazy. It's a step away from solitary confinement, which has been long understood to be a form of torture. And you know, really, they're not terrorists. This is the wrong place to put them. And again, our country is made less safe by doing so.
David Heilbronner. He's the co-creator, alongside Kate Davis, of the documentary film The Nuremberg Sting, which we're screening tomorrow night at 7 o'clock at the Downtown Library in Salt Lake City, part of our Through the Lens series in partnership with the Utah Film Center. David will be joining us there at the screening. His wife, Kate, will be with us via Skype. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. David Heilbronner, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. Technical direction from Mike Anderson. Michael Shea is our intern. The program produced by Elaine Clark and Benjamin Bombard. I'm Doug Fabrizio.